Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday morning. It's April 23rd. We've got 43 degrees under some cloudy skies, 47 in the Heber Valley. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Yeah, good morning, Wasatch back. Clouds are here to stay for your Wednesday. We are going to see a chance of some showers pick up into the afternoon as well. Highs will be in the low 60s, so southwest flow is the direction our air is coming from, and so typically that west and northeast will be the direction we'll see showers move from, which, of course, they move up and over the front side of the Wasatch Range into the backside near Park City. Could get a bit of a rain shadow there, so not a lot of moisture is expected from what showers are moving through, but there's a chance of rain nonetheless. Maybe even a thunderstorm into the afternoon. Overnight lows will be in the upper 30s. They're expected to be at least tonight into tomorrow. On Thursday, a high of 58. Plan on some additional thunderstorm activity. We will see quieter weather Friday, Saturday. Still seeing partly cloudy skies, but less of a threat of any showers. Strong south flow will bump temperatures back up into the low 60s for highs. And then a stronger storm system still on track to move in this weekend. Should be here on Sunday, bringing chances of rain and snow showers back to Park City. Highs will drop to just 50, 47 on Monday, then rebounding Tuesday next week. Looks like the active stretch, or at least the storm, will linger into Monday, Tuesday. So snow showers, if not rain and snow showers on Monday, because highs will be near 47, but then clearing some on Tuesday next week with a high of 54. For Heber, mostly cloudy, a high of 68 today. A chance of a few isolated showers, maybe a thunderstorm. Thunderstorms expected tomorrow, 67 for the high, 70. As we get into Friday, similar temperatures on Saturday with partly cloudy skies. And then that wintry mix is expected Sunday, Monday next week with a few lingering showers into Tuesday. Temperatures should bottom out for overnight lows in the mid to low 30s Sunday, Monday mornings. And then rebound to about, again, 61 for highs on Tuesday next week.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Nate.
You bet.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with the Director of Community Engagement with Utah Waterways, Cynthia B. We'll be talking about the results of a new study that shows most Utahns don't think we'll have enough water in 20 years. Park City Manager Matt Dias will be in to preview this week's City Council meeting. And finally, the founder of the Little P Project, Heather Manson, with details on their upcoming fundraiser, May 17th. Well, behind the scenes of the Heber City Council's decision not to continue using ranked choice voting were dozens of public comments, lawsuit threats, and concerns about misinformation. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
The council voted unanimously April 15th to return to conventional voting for the 2025 municipal elections, when the mayor and two city council seats will be on the ballot. The decision followed weeks of often heated public discussion about which system better serves Heber voters. The issue prompted a deluge of public feedback. Mayor Heidi Franco said the city got over 300 comments about ranked choice voting, with more than 75% opposed. KPCW obtained and reviewed roughly 80 of those emails and found similar opinions. In the lead up to the council's vote, Franco also published two blog posts advocating against ranked choice voting. Those posts were fact-checked by Utah Ranked Choice Voting Executive Director Colleen Potter in an email sent to Heber leaders and staff hours before the council vote. In her email, which was shared with KPCW, Potter described the mayor's recent blog posts as misleading at best and accused Franco of trying to undermine the system of voting, as well as her colleagues who support it. In particular, Potter, who previously served as Heber's mayor, called out Franco's comments that over half of the voters' ballots were not counted in the 2023 city election.
Yeah, it's just simply not true that their ballots were not counted. Like, every ballot that had a vote on there that was discernible was counted.
She said it's not true that ballots are thrown out if they don't rank every candidate available. Voters can rank as many or as few choices as they want. Franco declined to comment on Potter's fact-checking email. She told KPCW Tuesday, "The people have spoken, and that's what is important." Misconceptions about uncounted ballots showed up in many of the dozens of emails sent to the Heber City Council ahead of their decision. One Heber resident, Ken McConnell, wrote, "I had to vote for someone I didn't want, or my ballot would not be counted." He said he believed people who only voted for a few of the 11 candidates in the 2023 city council race had their ballots discarded without their knowledge. Potter said misinformation about uncounted ballots created unnecessary fear and frustration and anger. She said it's upsetting to see growing election distrust in Heber.
People who don't really understand how ranked choice voting works now believe that perhaps their ballot didn't count. And they feel like somehow people at the city are manipulating the process to hurt them and to not have their voice be heard. So it's simply not true. And it creates an atmosphere where there's a lack of trust in the people and the process, and it has no basis in reality.
Potter also pushed back against Franco's claim that ranked choice elections can't be audited, stating local elections officials can and do audit ranked races. Concern about voting equipment also showed up in the public comments. Voter Galen Latimer said she didn't trust a system that, quote, depends on a machine to tabulate each round, which cannot be audited. And Nancy Hart said she talked to other Heber residents who, quote, felt that the computers can be adjusted to favor some candidates more than others. Officials conduct public tests to ensure the voting machine's integrity and help residents understand the ballot counting process. It's called a logic and accuracy test, and it's required by law. Machines are used to tally the ballots in every election, whether ranked choice or traditional. Potter said she thought the city council voted the only way it could.
They certainly don't want people feeling like they're not being listened to. They want people to trust the election. But I think it was unfortunate that the mayor would send something out to create that kind of misinformation and mistrust of her colleagues.
Some council members hinted during the discussion April 15th they thought ranked choice voting worked well, but they were voting in line with the public comments they received. Council member Scott Phillips, for example, said he was supporting traditional voting, not because I think it's better, but because I think the fighting needs to stop. Phillips previously called Franco out for spreading false information at multiple city council meetings this spring. Here's their exchange on March 4th during a discussion of ranked choice voting.
Are you comfortable with over 55% of the people trying to vote saying, I'm not voting anymore? If you're comfortable with over half of them, then that's fine.
You're lying.
Just say
to
you
the
are.
Public. You're lying to the public. This is
no,
a blatant
lie. No, it's the
lie.
Numbers. This I'm not lying, say. Scott.
Mayor.
You're slandering
Mayor.
Me.
A few minutes later, the argument flared up again.
I can't listen to any more lies. It's just driving me crazy.
Oh, it's interesting, your choice of language. I wonder if this is the kind of leadership that Heber City wants when you accuse like this in a public meeting.
2 weeks later, on March 18th, they picked up the disagreement where they left off.
If you vote for the losing candidate, your vote still counts. That's the message that
I think there's debate on that.
Among the public comments, the city also received one legal threat from a group of 10 residents. They wrote, should you vote to adopt, expand, or continue the implementation of ranked choice voting in Heber City's municipal elections, we intend to pursue legal action to challenge such a decision as unconstitutional. They argued that ranked choice voting is coercive. Some locals said they prefer the system. Marianne Meek said she likes the system because it saves time and money. And Joylyn Jepson said she likes ranked choice voting because she thinks it more accurately reflects the voice of citizens. And she said it makes campaigns more civil and more open to third-party candidates. But after two elections with the system, Heber's door to ranked choice voting is closed, at least for the foreseeable future. This winter, the Utah legislature declined to extend the ranked choice voting pilot program, and it will expire in January 2026. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
The results of a recent study show that many Utahns don't think we'll have enough water 20 years from now. On the phone to tell us more about the study and how concerned residents can make a difference, I have Cynthia Bee. She's the Director of Community Engagement with Utah Waterways. Good morning, Cynthia. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so first start by telling us what is Utah Waterways.
Yeah, so Utah Waterways is a statewide nonprofit, a 501c3, that was created by the Utah State Legislature, or directed to be created, I should say, in 2023. So we're kind of like the UCARE of water. And our goal is to coordinate with all of the entities already engaged in conservation, streamline efforts, and broaden our base so that we can, you know, rapidly speed up the adoption of these waterways practices throughout the state in every sector.
Mm-hmm. So how is it that you're funded then if you're a creation of the state legislature?
So we have about two-thirds of our board are different state agencies, and then we also have private sector agencies. So some of like Zions Bank and Rio Tinto, Larry Miller Group, and Intermountain Health. And so that's helping us kind of bridge the gap between things that happen within the government realm and then also in that private sector so that we can create solutions that work from every angle that, needs to be addressed.
Okay. So
funding comes from both sources, I should say.
Yeah. So according to the study we referenced, just under half of Utahns seem to believe the state has enough water to meet our needs today, but 57% doubted that we'll have enough water 20 years from now. So tell me about the study. I mean, who did it? How many people were involved?
So the study was a collaborative effort between Utah Waterways, the Nature Conservancy, the Utah Division of Water Resources, and the Office of the Great Salt Lake Commissioner. And so we teamed up together to fund the study, and the study was actually done by Envision Utah. And as we all know, they have, you know, extensive experience doing these types of studies here in Utah with our residents.
Okay, and you asked how many people? You have any details about the survey?
So there were two different kind of sessions. We had kind of a small group initially, and they were from all over the state. And then they did a larger group, so we did both the qualitative and quantitative analysis, and a larger group consisted of over 800 Utahns, and again, from each region of the state. We needed to get the overall effort. And the idea was just to see, where are we at? You know, as we're a new organization starting out, we know a lot of it has changed, and Utahns have made a lot of progress and have gained a lot of understanding over the last decade. But it's been a decade since a significant study was done, and so we felt like it was time. So that we can see where we're at as a state, what messages resonate, what do people know, not know, where are they engaged, and where do we need to put more work in from all these different entities that are involved.
Sure. Besides not feeling like we're going to have enough water in two decades, other important findings showed that respondents rated water as the state's number two priority between housing and cost of living. So this is a big deal.
It is a big deal. You know, we... In a drought year, we're number one. In a non-drought year, it's number two. Like, what was really encouraging about the study is Utahns get it. We know. Now, so the question isn't, do we need to conserve water? We all know that needs to happen. The question is just, where are the best places to do that? How do we drive that forward? And where's the best places for everyone to engage to return, you know, the best results?
Yeah, so the survey did also show that Utahns are split on whether or not their actions can make a difference through water conservation. So can they?
Absolutely. You know, the big thing is just be a good steward of what you have control over. You know, it's kind of funny because lowest common denominator is what we tell our kids, you control you. So, you know, we're working with absolutely every sector. We're working to get with our water districts and our cities to pass ordinances that require water efficiency in landscapes on new construction. We want that new construction to bear more of its own impact. And so that's an easy place to start, prevent the problem in the first place, right? And in cities where they're willing to do that, of course, incentives have been made available. And more than 63% of the state's population, it's probably closer to 70 now, are in areas that qualify for cash back for replacing lawn with other types of landscaping. Does not mean a rockscape that you can only, you know, that take all the plants out and just have rocks. Of course, that's nothing we're promoting or funding. But to do these more water efficient landscapes, you know, there is money available.
All right. Now, surprising to me was the finding that respondents erroneously believe that more water is being used on their indoor uses, like taking a shower or washing the dishes, as opposed to their outdoor irrigation and landscaping. So what will make the most difference? I mean, cutting a shower down a minute really doesn't matter, huh?
I wouldn't say that it doesn't matter. It's just, it's not going to produce the same outcomes. It's because it's a way of being in the world, right? It's a small habit, but it's a way of staying conscious about what we're doing. And you know, but is it the most effective? No, the most effective is to switch out landscapes. That's why we focus there. But I think the reason people don't know is just when you're asked that question, you think about, well, how am I engaging with water? And you think about where you're touching it, where you're using it. But you don't see it. Outside is out of sight, out of mind. Mm-hmm. But it is amazing to know that about 60% of a homeowner's annual water use is outdoors in their landscape. And so think about the length of year we're actually irrigating. So, you know, 6 months of the year, we're using 60%. And so that's really, you know, the key is just to be a conscious user. That's one of the reasons that they have smart controller rebates for anyone in the state of Utah to upgrade their hardware so that you don't have to be consciously thinking about it all the time. You set up your system to take care of that for you, right? And so we really want to encourage that. And that's a great way to do it, you know. So, yeah, we can all, you know, if we all do a little bit, it adds up quickly. When I say a little bit, a typical quarter-acre lot that's landscaped with, you know, mostly lawn, the generic Utah
landscape, it's using almost 200,000 gallons of water a season. And if you cut that down, even if you don't even have to eliminate all lawn, if you cut that down to about 25% lawn and then balance it out with plants and seeding areas and other things, you can cut that use down by two-thirds. So when you say that it's, you know, each individual property, we're talking the capacity to save easily 100,000 gallons just on one property. So it might be a drop in the bucket, but we're talking some, you know, those drops are pretty additive.
Mm-hmm. Also interesting is that respondents place a high level of responsibility on state and local governments to solve the water shortage in Utah. And what you're telling me is that, well, they can certainly help things along with ordinances, but it comes down to what each person does. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the balance, right? So government agencies are doing it from two sides. So our water districts and the Utah Division of Water Resources are funding incentive programs. So those who have existing landscapes that are willing to change out and reduce their lawn, they get incentivized to do that, right? To help offset the cost. And then we're on the opposite side. We're working on those ordinances that prevent the problem from moving into the future. The state requires a water conservation plan of cities. There's new legislation that just passed this year that allows cities to add a fourth tier of pricing so they can, if people get into that very excessive use category, the pricing can go up. So you've got the pricing signal. So the tools have been made available. But at the end of the day, it comes down to how the public chooses to use them or not use them. I don't think any of us want to live in a world where the government dictates exactly how much you can use. So it's that, you know, carrots and sticks and everything we can do. But at the end of the day, you control you.
Yeah. Another finding that you saw shows support for these water-wise landscapes. And I guess what has changed is just that the public's favor of that over the last 10 years. So a study had been done that showed people didn't like these water-wise landscapes at that point?
Yeah. So I actually sat in that original focus group in 2014, and I got to watch, and when we asked them what they thought of water-efficient landscapes, by and large, the group said they look messy and disorganized. And so that, you know, that really got us thinking, and our team developed a design style called Localscapes. That's a Utah style of landscaping. It can involve lawn. It doesn't need to. It can be lawnless as well. But wherever you fall on that range of a localscape, you get a planned, organized, attractive landscape as the outcome. So, you know, people will do it if they're getting something of value to them. It's a big change to change your yard. We want to make sure that people that do it have an outcome they're proud of.
Okay. So what should, you know, so as we know, we should look to our outdoor water use if we're really serious about saving water. Talk to me about some of the suggestions for doing that and where people could probably find more information.
Yeah, for sure. So one of the big things would be to switch to drip irrigation in planting beds. That's where a lot of the water waste happens. And the thing is, when you are watering it with overhead spray, you're providing water over 100% of that surface. You get weeds because you're cultivating them. So when you switch to drip irrigation, you're just watering the plants you're trying to grow, and you're disadvantaging those weeds, which helps, and it decreases that overall water use. So we want people to kind of shrink the lawn. You don't have to necessarily get rid of all of it, especially like along the Wasatch back. You can have a small area. But we really want to just preserve lawn for places it serves a recreational purpose rather than using it as a default ground cover. So if I call it the chair test. If you can't sit a chair on it or you can't kick a soccer ball around on it, it probably shouldn't be lawn. Or if it's not a place you would tell the kids to go play, like a park strip, for example. And so that's it. You know, we're not trying to be anti-lawn or anything, but we got to dial it back. And so that's a great way that people can do it. And we encourage people to do just even a small project, a park strip flip, or you know, get used to it, try something new, experiment on a small piece of your property. When you feel confident you've got it figured out, then we can spread it. What we don't want people to do is take on more than they can handle and get overwhelmed. So the places to get information on that, there's localscapes.com, which will have classes. And then for rebates, go to slowtheflow.org, and we can connect you through. And then we're also working on tools that bring down the amount of decision making that you have to do. So in the next couple of weeks, we'll be introducing, probably in the next week, the Utah Plant Selector, which is in a beta form right now, that will help people make those decisions about, well, what should I plant? So we're trying to just really make it easier for people to do that. There's free classes, there's incentives, and we just really want to see people take advantage of those things.
Yeah, so this UTAP Plant Selector, tell me a little bit more about that. It'll be offered, what, on a website, or is it an app? Or?
Yeah, if you go to slowtheflow.org, you can try the beta out. We're making a couple of adjustments on the UX for it right now so that it's got fewer clicks, you know, got to have the fewest clicks. But one of the things that people feel overwhelmed about is just making decisions about what should I plant. And they go in circles and they go in circles, and it, you know, it's frustrating. And if you can't get something, you don't know how to replace it. And so the Plant Selector just starts out with some designer recommended combinations for our area. And then you can actually go in and mix and match. It's like Tinder for plants. And so that, you know, we have a suggested combination, but then you can click on it and go in and see what other options would work that would fill the same function. And so on the front end, it's solving the problem for the homeowner and making sure they have nonstop bloom all season in their yard without having to know a lot about plants. But on the back end, we're using that to provide data and to drive demand behind the plants we need to have more available so that Utah's plant supply chain can keep up with the demand that's being created through these great programs.
Okay. And tell me, you've got a few Slow the Flow demonstration landscapes for people to see. These are all in Salt Lake County. So what would people see if they made the trek down to the valley?
Well, so Salt Lake, they don't even need to come in person. We're going to make it all available online. But Salt Lake County is one of the funding organizations for these demonstration gardens. And the purpose in doing them isn't so much like a come see this landscape. It's we are documenting the process of how the change gets made. So a lot of what's overwhelming is, you know, you sit in the class and there's a PowerPoint, and that's great. But, you know, there's little parts and things involved that are, how do I do that and in what order? And so we're going to use these four landscapes to show how we solve the most common challenges that most people are dealing with, one of which is slopes. And how do I not kill mature trees? How do I switch irrigation and retain the tree health and things like that that have been a difficulty for people that we want to explain in a very straightforward way. So that's what the demonstration projects are giving us a chance to do. So it's, yes, there's a physical landscape that's getting exchanged out, but the purpose of it is really just to document that process so all of us can feel more confident making those changes.
Okay. And finally, I wanted to ask you about, because there are certainly very different differences in water conditions, both in the south of the state, the north of the state, even the Wasatch Front and the Wasatch Back. So talk a little bit about how it impacts our activities.
Yeah. So one of the big challenges is that water is regional, right? And so up north, we're having an okay year. Down south, it's pretty sketchy. And so they need to just conserve this year and really in southern Utah. In northern Utah, where we're having kind of a, quote, normal year, this is exactly the time we want people to make changes. Because when you're changing out plants and things, they need additional water to get established. So it's kind of a counterintuitive that if I'm switching to a water-wise landscape, I'm actually going to need more water that first season to get those new plants established and growing. And so the best time to change that is when we're not in a drought.
Okay. Any other tips, any other thoughts about the study, Cynthia, that you'd like to pass along?
You know, we feel very positive about it. We feel like Utahs understand what's at stake here. They understand the challenges and really are very excited about moving forward. It's just creating the right tools and getting that momentum is where we're at. But in terms of what do they know. And now it's just getting action behind that knowledge.
Okay. Cynthia B. is the Director of Community Engagement with Utah Waterways. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Park City Councilmember Ryan Dickey announcing his candidacy for Park City Mayor. In a press release, he says that he is pledging to bring strong, result-focused leadership to the office and planning to move Park City forward. Dickey's in his fourth year on the city council. He was first appointed back in 2021 for a partial term to fill the seat of current Mayor Nan Worrell. He was then reelected to Park City Council by a full term in 2023. Well, Park City officials are considering altering the local land use appeals process to make it more efficient. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports the move could affect future development projects.
On Wednesday, the Park City Planning Commission will review a proposed ordinance that would bring changes to the city's land use appeals process. The Park City Council created a three-member appeals panel in 2023 to handle appeals of Planning Commission decisions. The panel currently has a vacancy after one of its members resigned. The rule changes under consideration would replace the appeals panel with a professionally trained land use hearing officer, which is common in other Utah cities. The ordinance also incorporates a new state law that allows city councils to settle land use litigation with a private property owner if a denied appeal ends up in court. Park City Councilmember Jeremy Rubel recently inquired about using the new law for the proposed redevelopment of the Yarrow Doubletree Hotel on Park Avenue. The owner of the Yarrow filed an appeal this month seeking to overturn the Planning Commission's move to deny the project due to its 45-foot height. The appeal is now on hold after an attorney for the Yarrow asked the city to delay in light of the board vacancy. If the city moves forward with the proposed changes, the Yarrow appeal would be reviewed by a hearing officer. Other changes in the ordinance include moving the appeal authority for historic district design reviews from the Board of Adjustment to the Historic Preservation Board. That process was in the spotlight recently when the Board of Adjustment upheld a resident appeal of billionaire Matthew Prince's controversial proposed home on Treasure Hill. Prince has moved to challenge the appeal in 3rd District Court. The draft ordinance also incorporates a new state law banning public hearings during appeals. The Planning Commission will consider forwarding a recommendation to the City Council, which has final authority over such amendments. The Council is tentatively scheduled to consider the proposal on May 15th. Also Wednesday, the Commission will review a proposal to build a new 5,000-square-foot private restaurant close to Deer Valley's Bandana Run. According to a staff report, the restaurant would have ski-in, ski-out access and be exclusively for members of the Talisker Club. Wednesday's meeting is scheduled to begin at 5:30 at City Hall. The agenda and a link to attend virtually can be found online at kpcw.org. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Park City Council meets on Thursday in work session starting at 3:20. In the studio with a preview of the meeting, I have City Manager Matt Dias. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so thanks for being here. First up, a discussion of the Park City Housing Resolution and 5-year moderate income housing plan amendments. Based on the council's discussion back in February, it sounds like the plan is to adjust the city's affordable housing goals and priorities now rather than wait till 2027 when the next state plan is due. So with Summit County's AMI going up again, as we reported this week, how is that going to impact your plan?
Potentially it has a great impact, and I think we're trying to actually get ahead of that. So proactively, area median income is a hard measure, particularly in resort communities. As some of your listeners recall, and you know, we participate in the League of Cities and Towns. We participate in the Colorado Association of Ski Towns. And this metric is becoming more and more complicated for places that have these large income disparities. And so one of our responses to that is to potentially consider what's called a workforce wage metric, which is something that really meets sort of the lower income echelons of our community, particularly those commuting in and out and in the service sector or frontline jobs, more so than the AMI, which can be skewed in a community like ours that has really large incomes and really incomes on the lower end. And so that's one response to that, as well as we're also looking at actually increasing our goal. Previous council has established a goal for 15% of our workforce living in town, and I think that continues to be the goal, but as our workforce grows and as our community grows, actually increasing that number numerically as the percentage goes up.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because I mean, I've brought it up over the years. At the same time we are doing this, the city council continues to approve new development, and we're talking about some huge developments on our plate. Of course, we've got the snow park base development, just a matter of time before you see something similar at Park City Mountain. The Main Street area plan calls for, what, maybe 3 more hotels. So we continue to approve developments that require only more service workers, making maybe, what, $20 an hour? It doesn't help our situation. I mean, right? I mean, the saying goes that if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. But we just keep digging this housing hole even deeper. So at what point do our leaders say, what? Wait, we have reached our capacity. I mean, we've do so many studies. Why haven't we done a study on what our town's carrying capacity is? We've been talking about it for decades. Still nothing.
Yeah, I guess it depends on how you look at it. Obviously, in this state, in Utah, private property rights are a priority, and they are passed down through legislative mandates and otherwise. And we have property owners in this city, probably much like yourself, that own a piece of property, and they have rights. And those rights comes with the inherent zoning and the densities that that area or that zone will apply. And so many of those projects that you just listed are existed or perhaps even vested property rights. And so you can imagine a scenario, we'd go into a private property owner that has vested property rights and say, we're going to take those away from you. That's basically a perilous position for a municipality to be in, particularly in the state of Utah. That being said, I think we're trying to supplement the growth and development and the receipts from the resort economy. So the sales taxes that we obtained, the preferential property taxes that we obtained through secondary homeowners, and reinvest that into workforce housing programs. And, you know, by and large, Park City's been a leader in the state of Utah. I think we were the first housing authority ever formed in the state of Utah. We have almost 700 units under deed-restricted affordable housing. We currently have the largest affordable housing rental project under construction in the Bonanza District. And here we're contemplating trying to obtain 15% of our workforce living in the community, irrespective of the growth and development, and continuing to take the receipts from the resort economy and reinvest those in our community. And workforce housing is one of those ways.
Yeah, so that's the number that you've come up with to meet that 15% is about 1,200 units. So were all of these proposed developments accounted for that, the Main Street Area Plan, Snow Park,
I think it depends. So there's sort of two things that are happening. One is that the municipality is a developer of affordable housing, and we're partnering with the private sector to develop affordable housing. And through our development process, private property owners that we were just talking about are also required to provide affordable housing as part of their development. So there's sort of different means or methods that are coming together to try to support and provide sustenance to this part of our community. Going forward, though, we have what's called a pipeline. And a pipeline is sort of our projected inventory of affordable housing that will come online. And again, that's both development through the municipality, that's partnering with the private sector, and then it's through the regulatory environment. So when we're looking at changing our metrics or updating our goals, we're sort of in a nuanced approach about accounting for what's in the pipeline. You mentioned the Deer Valley Base Area redevelopment. That's one of those projects that will deliver affordable housing as a requirement, and things like that are tabulated into our pipeline.
Okay, let's move on. At 410, an update on the capital budget. We've heard from golf manager Vaughn Robinson, the golf course, looking at a big one, $6 to $10 million irrigation project. That's years off. Where are we, though, with some of the other high-ticket items in this upcoming year's budget?
Yeah, I think excitingly, this year's capital budget actually redirects almost $8 million, I'd say, to other or higher priority areas. And we've done that through different ways. We've suspended existing projects. We're sort of redeploying impact fees, which are obtained through development permits, and then redeploying some of our redevelopment authority money. So big projects on the horizon. We're plowing almost $10 million into support an elevated level of service for a park and ride on the 248 corridor. We're adding money to complete the pools project at the PC Mark, renovating the locker rooms at the Mark, some trails and trailheads, renovating the lobby and the ice arena, providing an ice rink outdoor container for the outdoor ice rink that we have at City Park, buying snow plows, equipment. So it's a comprehensive capital budget where we've actually been able to sort of redeploy almost $7 or $8 million into higher priority projects, transportation, housing, trails, multi-use pathways. It's an extensive list of capital investment. Our facilities are really important to us, and we try to maintain those at a high level.
Whatever happened to the redo of Lower Park Avenue? Because this was a priority 2 years ago.
Yeah, it's been suspended, quite frankly. I think, that's one of those projects that had sort of just been vacillating for a number of years and ended up in sort of a quixotic place with regard to its level of prioritization. For a number of years, I think that was contemplated as sort of a a major corridor to sort of access Old Town. As things have evolved and changed, we've really pushed high volumes of traffic and sort of that destination traffic up onto the major arterials and out of our residential neighborhoods. And as you know, that street in particular has a senior center, a library, a city park, a skate park, and we've really tried to make that a residential zone because our plans changed that sort of negated the necessity to upgrade it to sort of a higher level facility to really be traffic oriented, and instead it's residential oriented now, and that's reduced our need to renovate it.
Okay, looking ahead, will residents see a tax decrease this year, coming year, with the payoff of open space bond?
They will, and I can't remember the specifics of it. I think it's the second year out of 3 years in a row now that we retired some debt, and because of that, there is an adjustment to the property taxes for Park City Municipal's portion of that property tax. As you know, your property tax is a multitude of political jurisdictions, and Park City Municipals are a relatively small component of that overall, and so I think the taxes will decrease a little bit this year. And in my lifetime, I don't think there's ever been a property tax increase from the municipality that we're aware of.
All right. Moving on, the Bonanza Park Land Management Code amendments. Looking at this, at the map, I see that the Yarrow Doubletree property is included in this area. The Planning Commission recently turning down the proposal, which included 45-foot height, which included a 45 height exception. Now the planning department asking for changes in this BOPA area so that buildings can go to 45 feet in certain circumstances. So this feels hypocritical.
Yeah, I guess I'd key in on your certain circumstances. I think, I believe this application as a subset to the overall discussion of the Bonanza Park Land Management Code updates. It's a specific project. I think it was before the Planning Commission for almost 9 or 10 months and has all sorts of intricacies, and ultimately was denied by the Planning Commission. So subset. Secondarily, this community went through probably a 14-month land use process, community charrettes, open houses, obtaining public input, and working with the Planning Commission to update that zone in its entirety. And so we're sort of coming down to the 5-yard line now of teasing out it's the zone's proposed feasibility, how it impacts private property owners. But to your point, I don't necessarily want to use the term performance zoning, but I will. The way I interpret this new code is there's some performance zoning aspects of it where you will be able to obtain, let's say, for example, more height in certain areas or less setbacks in other areas if you're providing greater community benefit. And so I want to separate these two items because one is a deliberate planning process under an existing code, and the gives and gets of that are entirely separate than what is a standalone process, 16-month community process that has a very clear table of gives and gets, which the Planning Commission can work with the development application and trying to return community benefit in exchange for those gets.
So should the Doubletree Singerman Real Estate come back once these amendments are made?
I mean, that would be entirely up to them, and that's why I sort of want to separate these. I think the Planning Commission was deliberate, and they're processing it under the existing code using the tools that they had. Looking ahead, that would be up for the applicant.
Yeah, and I guess I just got to bring up, because we originally purchased this property because the city didn't want to have to deal with the density that the former owner was proposing on the property, 4-story buildings, 45-foot height limits.
Wait, which property? We were talking,
I'm talking about
BOPA.
Yeah, okay. I'm talking about BOPA. So the promise was basically the city would build within the code when we agreed to spend $19.5 million. But now we're changing the code, and you're saying, well, that's okay because we have these planning studies that show that residents want a mixed-use development with tall buildings.
Well, fundamentally, I would say absolutely appropriate for the city to treat itself like it would any other applicant, period. City will treat itself like any other applicant. So any application that the city or its partners would push through to the Planning Commission would be under the same codes that the private sector would. And so absolutely, I would agree with that sentiment that we'll hold ourselves to the same standard. We would use the same codes to process our application. And like any city or town, there are elements of the code that you can request additional height, reduce your setbacks, underground parking. There's a whole planning process, and we would be upheld to the same standards as any other private applicant. So absolutely.
Yeah, once these, but again, I mean, that's what we were told in 2017. We're buying this property because it's too dense is the way that the developer wants to do it, the former property owner. We're doing exactly what the former property owner.
No, I guess I would beg to differ, and I hope it doesn't come across as argumentative. So to be clear, the land management code is the development code that obviously covers things like density and height and setbacks and open space and the development kind of pattern of the community. And that needs to change over time to reflect the needs of the community. Our environment changes, our economy changes, the people that live in this town change over time. There's certain things that don't change, like our historic structures and preservation. And so as that land management code evolves and changes to respond to the needs of our residents and our businesses and our visitors, so too do the applications that are coming in and seeking approval or feedback from the Planning Commission. And I would just counter that's entirely appropriate. And that's how basically every other city or town I've ever either worked in or worked with or otherwise has to operate. You want to be able to respond to changes in the world and in the environment. By way of an example, transportation changes, the way people get around and move changes. And so the development pattern, how the community looks and feels, should reflect that.
Real quick, what's the latest with the BRT lanes on 224? Have you figured that out with UDOT, with High Valley Transit?
Yeah, that's a fair question. So we've had a couple conversations with Summit County, High Valley Transit, and UDOT. And we'll have a verbal update tonight from the mayor and a couple council members that have been working with those entities and trying to sort this out towards the end. And so I guess we'll have a verbal update tonight. We'll sort of keep you posted on that. But working, you know, fully engaged with those three entities, trying to move that project forward. We understand how important it is for the Wasatch Back, how important it is for Summit County, how important it is for Park City. Just trying to right-size it in the right places.
Okay, Matt, I got to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks. I appreciate it, Lizzie. Have a good day.
That's Park City City Manager Matt Dyche. The annual Little P Project Gala will be held Saturday, May 17th at National Ability Center. In the studio with details, I have Heather Manson. She is founder and president of the Little P Project. Good morning.
Good morning.
I should also identify you as the mother of Parker, your sweet young daughter who passed away in 2022. So tell us a little bit about Parker before we get into the details, your fundraiser.
Parker was a vibrant, effervescent spirit, full of life. She was 11 years old when she passed away. She was diagnosed with pediatric sarcoma in 2020. We moved here in June of 2020, so she was diagnosed literally that month we moved here. But Parker was like any, 9-year-old girl. She did not want to be labeled as a child with cancer. She just wanted to be normal and live a full life. She loved dancing. She loved animals. She loved people. She really soaked up every second of life while she was here. And she still remains a big inspiration for me. And that's what helps me to keep moving forward and keep her name alive.
So pediatric sarcoma, what is, it's a cancer?
It's a type of cancer she had, and there are different types of sarcoma, and it's typically in children and teenagers, actually. It can be rare in adults, but it's not the easiest cancer to treat, and I would say with Parker's cancer, it's one of those where they do a lot as far as chemo, radiation, surgery. Hers was soft tissue, so hers was in her abdomen, but it can be in the bone. And a lot of times with those patients with osteosarcoma, which is in the bone, they have to amputate. So it's a pretty aggressive form of treatment, which is why when we've been through that journey with Parker and seeing it, we realized there needed to be more research around better treatments.
And what she did then was kind of start this foundation and way to keep her memory alive, but also to raise money for research?
Yes. So originally, it was started by my husband and I, and our main focus was on research. And that was more of a mom and dad thing. I think for Parker, We decided to also allocate money to families at primary children's that are undergoing treatment for sarcoma who are in financial distress. And one thing with Parker going through a cancer journey during the pandemic, it was pretty lonely. She couldn't connect with other children, and I think she really craved that. And I think that that is part of Parker us like helping families that are going through that journey to lighten the load a little bit with whether it be utility bills or mortgages or anything that's helps them to kind of take that off the table and the parents can just focus on their child.
So this is the third annual?
This is the third annual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So when and where? I mentioned May 17th.
It is May 17th, Saturday, May 17th at the National Ability Center. Registration will start around 5:30 and then the program will begin around 7. And it's a of course, it's just sad. We'll talk about cancer, so that's sad. And we'll talk about Parker and her journey, which is sad. But we also want to bring in more inspiration of Parker's spirit into that room. And so there will be a performance with Summit Dance Project. That's where she danced. And we try to get creative there and infuse a little bit of Parker through that performance. And then we'll end the evening with a DJ and a dance so everyone just can enjoy the night. And every year we've done this, the last 2 years, it's pretty magical when we're in that space all together and celebrating Parker and doing good in her name. And it's just, it's just an inspirational night, I'll say that.
All right. Tickets range from $200 to a table of 10.
Table of 10. If you buy a table of 10, the tickets are around $175. If you just purchase individual tickets, it's $200. And last year we sold out. We had 240 people in that room. And that's what we're hoping to do again this year.
Okay. And again, so the proceeds, because you've got to pay for the food and mm-hmm. stuff, so mm-hmm. anything that's left over goes right then to this, the research and the parents helping. Yeah.
So for instance, last year we raised around $200,000, and we split that between two initiatives for research with COG. COG is Children's Oncology Group, and one portion of that $100,000 went towards a research project specifically for sarcoma. And we try to be more specific because there's so much cancer research, but we do feel like with this particular type of cancer, because it is rare, there's not a lot of money allocated federally to look at the research around this disease. The other portion's exciting. It's called ITSC. It's Integrated Translational Science Center. So basically, and I'll try to be brief here, but we are allocating money towards that, which looks at different clinical trials. And a lot of times clinical trials have an outcome they're looking for. This will help look at other things in these trials, because running a clinical trial specifically for pediatric cancer is expensive. So instead of just saying, we're going to look at this one outcome with the ITSC program, you can come in and you have the money to be like, okay, but what are these patients like presenting as? Or can we look at some DNA methylation or a genome or anything like that where they can kind of pick apart the science? And so that was exciting for this year that we were able to support that initiative. And then $60,000 went to help families in need at Primary Children's.
Wonderful. Yeah. Great. It sounds like a wonderful way to support a mm-hmm. special young girl. Little P Project. Little P comes, is that?
Little P, Parker's our youngest. And that was just her nickname, Little P. And it's funny, when we decided to start this foundation, it was just literally a week after she passed, and we were sitting around the table with her aunts and mom and dad and brother, sister, and that's what we all came up with. And we thought, okay, that's like, that's Parker, little P. And she's little P because she's the youngest. But if you knew Parker, she was not anything little. I mean, her spirit was just bright and big and really hard to contain. Like, she just spilled over love, spilled over joy, spilled over just like her love of life. But she liked being little P because she loved being the baby in our house. So, yeah.
Well, we're sorry for your loss, but what a, like I say, a great tribute to her.
Thank you.
All right, anything else you wanted to add? I just got a few seconds.
I, just again, Saturday, May 17th, National Ability Center. We'd love for you to come out and support our foundation and raise some money for pediatric sarcoma.
Okay, that's little P project.org.
Yes.
Heather, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.